Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of New Books in South Asia, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am your host, Madhuri. And today we are talking to Professor Alf Nielsen about his book, Adivasis and the State, Subalternity and Citizenship in India's Bhil Heartland. So Professor Nielsen is a professor of sociology at the University of Pretoria. But today he is joining us from what I'm told is a cold morning in Norway. Thanks so much for joining us here at New Books Network, Alf.
Thank you, Madhuri. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So before we jump into the book, why don't you start out by telling our listeners a little bit about your personal trajectory, your intellectual trajectory? I mean, what drew you to the Bhil heartland, to India, to sociology?
Well, my work reflects a trajectory where I've been interested since my late teens in issues of North-South relations, issues of development, and interested from a critical point of view, if you will. That made me search out, when I was an undergraduate student, social movements that protested, if you will, official development interventions, official narratives of what development was. This was in the late 1990s when the struggle against large dams in the Narmada Valley was entering what turned out to be its last major phase. Whilst doing research for my undergraduate dissertation, I ended up actually in the Narmada Valley, which is, of course, a central part of the Bhil heartland, where I started looking into the trajectory of the anti-dam movement, which subsequently became actually my doctoral research. And it's in the process of doing that work that I developed a more general interest in how we might understand social movements in remote regions, such as the ones that I've been working in, as telling us something about, if you will, the very essential parts of state formation and capitalist development, both in colonial and post-colonial India. So that's that in brief is an overview of the trajectory that's resulted finally in the book that we're talking about today.
So you've told me in our brief email correspondence that this book was almost 9 years in the making. Am I correct?
That's right. Yeah, it took almost a decade from the first bits of research till publication.
And, you know, it's held together by a collaborative, community-driven data collection process. Now, will you tell our listeners a little bit about Aadharshila and how you came up with this idea of, you know, collecting oral histories and what that experience was, right from training your interviewers to, you know, how the communities responded to this method of data collection? I mean, because, you know, sometimes this process of retelling stories from the past, especially contentious political stories from the past in a community environment, can be so powerful in and of itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me contextualize a little bit. When I did my doctoral research, I crisscrossed the Narmada Valley. I spent a lot of time in Pil Adivasi communities affected by the Sardar Sarovar project. So this is in the border area between Maharashtra, Gujarat, and Madhya Pradesh. And while I was doing that, I became aware of the fact that, or I noticed from the interviews I carried out, that whereas people felt very strongly about their opposition to the Narmada Dam projects and so on, and the defense of their livelihoods and their life worlds, what they really spoke in detail about was a form of mobilization that predated the Narmada Bachao Andolan, which took the form of local social movements, such as the ones that I write about in this book, that mobilized around basic democratic demands in relationship to the local state. And it's dawned on me that there was a story to be written in some detail there about the kind of collective agency and sense of identity and indeed citizenship that had emerged from those local social movements that in many ways had existed in the shadow of the Narmada Bachao Andolan. So when I started to do that or started working on that project, it started off in a very conventional way. I thought I would do the same thing as I did when I investigated the Narmada anti-dam movement, which was to go in to the area in question with an assistant who would help me with translation and so on and so forth. But luckily, one of my first interviews was with two middle-class activists who had been active with the Kerut Masul Chetna Sangat, which is one of the movements at the heart of this book, who had also been affiliated with Narmada Bachao Andolan, who at a certain point in their activist trajectory had shifted from Alirajpur town, which is in rural western Madhya Pradesh, to another locale quite nearby, and had set up a school for Adivasi children. The school in question is Atarshila. It's a school that practices alternative forms of pedagogy to provide education to young children and youth from a part of rural India where schooling is very often insufficient, sometimes entirely absent. I went there to conduct what you might call a pilot interview to get their story about the trajectory of the KMCS, the Kerut Masul Chetna Sangat. And then after our discussion, or after the interview, we sat down and we were chatting, and it was they actually, Amit and Jayashree, who suggested to me that it might be worth considering an alternative methodology. They said this because they had a long-standing interest in collecting the oral histories of activists in this part of Madhya Pradesh that had been involved with local Adivasi movements. They also suggested to me that a way of doing that would be to work with their teachers. The reason why they said that was that these teachers were themselves young Adivasis, many of whom had parents who had been actively involved with the activism that I wanted to research and to investigate. Now, I thought this sounded like a wonderful idea, much better than the sort of more conventional parachuting in and then airlifting out that characterizes way too much of our research. And we began the process soon after of bringing together teachers who were interested in participating in the work, discussing what it might look like, what it would entail to collect these oral histories of activism and resistance, and started devising an interview guide together. This interview guide was translated into local languages, and we started touring the area, which took almost a year and a half, collecting some 70 interviews, in-depth interviews and oral histories from activists. It's interesting what you mentioned in terms of the power of retelling these stories in a community setting, because I realized when I was trying to enumerate how many people we had interviewed, that there was no way of doing it, because very often you'd go to a village to interview one or two activists, and people would gather around and sit down and listen and then begin to interject, and all of a sudden you had a group interview, what this eventually left us with was quite a rich archive of stories of activism, stories that are very rarely told because these movements produce little by the way of a written archive. And it also became, I think, an interesting and rewarding exercise for the researchers involved, many of whom said that they had come to learn things that they'd only seen sort of from a distance and with the perspective of being a child at the time, of having their parents, for example, thrown in jail by local authorities for protesting or spending time away from the home and so on and so forth, and learning about issues that they had some kind of learning more about issues that they had some vague knowledge about before. So it was a very interesting exercise and really, I think, rewarding for all parties involved.
And the transcription process, was it also carried out on the ground simultaneously?
In part, it was, yeah. Some of the transcription was carried out subsequently, or all of it was carried out subsequently. Some of it was carried out with the help of people who weren't related to the actual data collection. And other bits involved the researchers as well. So there was that attempt, if you will, of integrating the research team along the way. I think it's important, though, when we discuss, you know, these kind of alternative methodologies, that this wasn't carefully worked out. It certainly wasn't flawless, and it certainly wasn't complete. In a sense, this was very much trial and error. It was learning by doing, and there are many more things that one would have wanted to do with the material collected, such as, for example, crafting small publications written in local languages, and so on and so forth, that it wasn't possible to do. So I wouldn't want to make this up as some kind of, or portray this as some kind of perfect, if you will, activist methodology. It was very much, something that we just did, which became very different from a conventional exercise, but which still had aspects to it that one would want to work on in a more longer term to get better, to adjust, and to make more relevant, if you will, to the needs of producing knowledge that's relevant to local communities and local communities that are very much involved in struggle.
Right, and the afterlife of these research initiatives are, themselves so underexplored and not yet
absolutely
fully understood. So I would be curious to return and ask these teachers, who doubled up as interviewers, and if, these conversations made them reassess and rethink their present moment. So,
well, it's very interesting to see that a lot of there's been a sort of resurgence, if you will, of mobilization by Adivasi youth in the region where we carried out this project. I've been wondering often about the extent to which this is something that resonates with what these researchers learned and became involved with through the collection of these oral histories.
Questions for your third book, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, moving from methodology to more theoretical waters, I, I'm familiar with your other writings and know that Gramsci has been an important theoretical interlocutor for you. Why and how do you continue, right, to find his ideas useful for grappling with contemporary India? Would you just maybe ruminate a little bit?
Sure. So Gramsci, for me, presents a kind of treasure trove, if you will, of conceptual tools that are so relevant to the study of subalternity and resistance, which has got to do with the fact that I think Gramsci had a very rare and very special grasp of the subtleties of both the ways in which dominant groups in any specific setting come to craft their hegemonic position, the ways in which power is exercised, but also limited. And conversely, I think he had a very fine-grained and indeed very acute understanding of how subaltern groups then negotiate the exercise of power from below. I think his view of these dynamics very often defy some of the watertight compartments that have animated, much of the debate around subaltern politics in India since the early 1980s by saying that, look, hegemony is never absolute and total. It's always negotiated. There are always limits, and those limits are inscribed, if you will, by the collective action of subaltern groups. It comes from the fact that subaltern groups do have an ability to say, okay, this far, but no further in relation to the exercise of dominance from above. And conversely, I think that Gramsci's thinking avoids pushing us in the direction of thinking about subaltern groups as though they exist in an autonomous domain, which is entirely removed from, the sort of world of belief systems and imaginaries that animate or underpin hegemony. I think it points us towards something that's really crucial, which is that rather than being, an autonomous actor that sort of engages in collective action on the basis of political imaginaries that are totally different from and other than those that constitute, if you will, the backbone of hegemony. What is so special about subaltern resistance and subaltern collective action is that it's predicated upon an ability to take idioms and institutions and practices that are actually intended to prop up the power of elite groups, the power of dominant groups, and turn them into, weapons of resistance. And it's that sort of tenacious capacity that that I wanted to call attention to. I wanted to call attention to, in this book in particular, what happens when subaltern groups actually come together and resist against all the odds. Because let's remember that we're talking about some of the most marginal groups, if you will, both economically and politically in Indian society. We're talking in this specific case about Adivasi communities that were ground down, if you will, by what I call the everyday tyranny of the local state. And in trying to get a grasp on that is precisely the deeply relational and deeply dialectical thinking that one finds in Gramsci that has proven so helpful. And I don't think it's entirely irrelevant here that Gramsci developed his theories not from, the standpoint of a detached academic, but from the standpoint of someone who, in his time, was very, very much involved in activism. So it's about theory that grows out of participating in movements, trying to understand movements, trying to understand the communities that are at the heart of those movements. And I think that gives you a different kind of theorizing, a theorizing that ultimately is more grounded in the realities, the actual realities of those very complex dialectical relations that exist between dominant groups and subaltern groups, between hegemony and between resistance.
Thank you. And, speaking of everyday tyranny, you begin the book by also paying attention to how this everyday tyranny is mediated by local rationalities as well, right? The fear, the resignation. Will you talk a little bit about how this local rationality within, right, Bhil communities and the power relations within Bhil communities are as important to pay attention to?
Well, what I argue in my book is that through persistent encounters with the local state over long periods of historical time, arguably since before independence, this way of thinking about how one relates to the local powers that be within these communities has come into being, which is characterized by a certain form of acquiescence. What we're talking about here is the fact that communities would accept, albeit begrudgingly, For example, forest guards coming to a village, taking away poultry, demanding bribes, beating up people, and so on and so forth. These myriad forms of extortion, which I document in the book. But it's also important to understand that the relationship was mediated by what you might call local elites internally in these Adivasi communities. Very often, patels and sarpanches, so let's call them village heads, village headmen, that who had a stake, if you will, in maintaining their position as mediators between the communities and the local state, because it gave certain benefits. This is an arrangement that came into being during a period which I also speak about in the book, which you might call sort of the late colonial era, that is from the early 1900s up until the 1920s, when in these princely states, one saw a development of a new administrative structure that hinged very much on the appointment of local figures within Adivasi communities, village headmen and so on and so forth, that could, if you will, be the bridgehead of the state into these communities. And I think it's important to understand that these bridgeheads and these mediators were a very important part of the power relations that these movements came up against. You know, they had to be challenged along with the state in order for communities to emerge, if you will, as collective entities that were insurgent, that challenged the workings of everyday tyranny. And that was often, if you will, more difficult than simply challenging the state, as far as I gather from the narratives that I've collected, in the sense that these were people who could also make life very difficult, if you will, for what I call ordinary Pil Adivasis, that is, Pil Adivasis with no stake as such in the existing power structure. So again, when I write about this, it's an attempt to bring out the many-layered nature, if you will, of state-society relations in this region, and to avoid any sort of simple dichotomy between subaltern groups on the one hand and dominant groups on the other.
And the transition from the colonial to the post-colonial order, what did that entail?
Well, what I argue in my book is that the areas which I look at were all princely states, but nevertheless they became, if you will, woven into colonial processes of state formation in Western India, that effectively subordinated Bheel communities to the power of what you might call a sort of a modern state that was slowly emerging. This relationship of subordination was reproduced after independence. It's remarkable in how little things changed in terms of local Bheels being more subjects than citizens, despite the fact that, of course, formally, with the introduction of universal franchise and so on and so forth in India after 1947, despite all of this, they were completely disenfranchised. This is an effect, I argue, in the book of the way in which Congress established alliances with local ruling classes, the former princely rulers, if you will, how these princely rulers became, in this particular area of Madhya Pradesh, in this particular area of Western India, became, if you will, the equivalent of the local dominant groups that we know mediated Congress rule elsewhere in India after 47. So here, what we see here is, in a sense, sort of the working of India's passive revolution in a remote rural region at a very local scale. And what it resulted in, of course, was the fact that the power of these groups, the power of the former princely rulers, which was very much power over Adivasi communities, was reproduced over time and was reproduced into into India's independence, and was only ruptured much later in the 1980s and 1990s when these local social movements started coming about. And it's been really important for me to bring out these links to say that these are not aberrations that we see here. You know, it's not about something that happened in a remote rural corner because the remoteness of the place, for example, allowed some kind of local despotism to evolve. This is about the way in which political power has been structured in India at a national scale, and the way in which that has led to the disenfranchisement of certain subaltern groups.
And speaking of citizens and subjects, I think throughout the book, you're very carefully critical of that civil-political dichotomy, right? And you frame the Adivasi Mukti Sangathan as well as the Khedut Mazdoor Chetna Sangat's work as a kind of, I think somewhere you quote legalism from below, right? As the way of perhaps better understanding these kinds of activisms. So will you perhaps elaborate a little bit about why it's important for us to step back from this dichotomy and complicate these social movements as not one thing or the other?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think generally what we should have learned at this point in time is that binaries are not very useful when it comes to understanding the dynamics of actually existing subaltern politics. Much of my book is predicated, if you will, on that sort of basic sensibility. So what I do in the book is that I engage in a close debate and a critical debate with Partho Chatterjee's work on the politics of the governed and the argument that subaltern groups in India today, although they engage with the state, engage with that part of the state which, if you will, is predicated upon governmentality rather than citizenship, civil society, and law. So what I found, and I think this resonates with a number of studies on subaltern politics in India today, is that quite contrary to Chatterjee's postulations, law, civil society, and citizenship were actually at the heart of what these movements that I've studied were mobilizing around. They were mobilizing around legality in state-society relations, demanding that local states both implement and follow the law, precisely because the role of the state, the presence of the state in this region was characterized by utter lawlessness, if you will, you know, by the constant breaking of law. So this became a very effective counter-hegemonic tool. Secondly, they created, through their insistence on legality in state-society relations, they created a very rudimentary civil society in the form of a space in which democratic transactions could take place between Adivasi communities and the local state. So rather than being sort of cordoned off, if you will, into what Chatterjee would call political society, I see these groups as creating a civil society. And finally, I also see them, demanding the right to have rights, which is at the very heart of citizenship, and then inflecting that with and expanding, if you will, the idea of what a citizen is by demanding local self-rule, by demanding control over natural resources, and so on and so forth. Fundamentally, what's at stake here is a concern with understanding what subaltern groups actually do when they mobilize, so that we can make informed judgments, if you will, of what works and what doesn't in terms of advancing subaltern emancipation. We don't get very far if we squeeze subaltern groups into analytical categories that have little relationship to what they actually do. So what I've tried to do here is to move away from, consistently move away from any kind of idea that's predicated on watertight compartments, any kind of idea that's predicated on democratic modernity being somehow only relevant to elite groups in India, and instead saying, what is it that happens when subaltern groups, those groups which have been disenfranchised or who have been marginalized within India's democratic modernity, claim it for themselves? What is it that happens then to power relations? What is it that happens then to the public sphere, and so on and so forth? And I've been trying to argue that democratic political modernity in India as elsewhere is very much shaped by the way in which subaltern groups seize hold of the idioms, the institutions, and the practices that are defining of that modernity. This is not about any kind of normative attachment to law, to civil society, and to citizenship, that kind of liberal normative attachment. It's about an analytical obligation, I think, or an analytical commitment to looking at what's actually being done by subaltern groups as they try to negotiate power from above.
Right, and the enthusiastic mobilization around, you know, the new rights agenda, be it the FRA, be it the NRA, the right to food. I mean, this is all a testament to the argument that you're making. So why then call it non-reformist reform?
Well, that is an argument that I make in the concluding chapter to my book. I wanted to write a conclusion that was somewhat different from a conventional ending to a book, where you sort of summarize your argument and throw in a couple of rhetorical flourishes about the power of subaltern resistance and so on and so forth. I wanted to try and say something about, if you will, what we can learn from the trajectory of these struggles. And it's important to sort of mention to our listeners that these struggles advanced, if you will, or democratized local state-society relations, but they were also subjected to quite savage repression from above, which I document towards the end of the book. So it's that sort of combination, if you will, of both achievements and limitations that lies at the heart of me trying to conclude the book by reflecting on what might it mean to construct a new form of oppositional politics that has the capacity to decisively disrupt power relations in this region. I turn to the phrase non-reformist reform, which was coined by André Gortz and which I became aware of through learning of the work of Ruthie Wilson Gilmore, and actually mobilization in a very different context, that is mobilization around prison reform, or prison abolition rather, in the US. It appeals to me because it's a term that enables us to overcome, again, if you will, watertight compartments or binaries that has very often hampered, I think, thinking about radical oppositional politics in the Indian context, where you're sort of talking either about revolution or you're talking about incremental reforms. The term non-reformist reform enables us to think what it might mean to grab a hold of institutions and idioms and practices that were initially conceived and designed as a way of extending hegemony, of ensuring the reproduction of hegemony, and turning them into tools for change that cannot be confined, if you will, within the parameters of the given social order or the currently existing social order. So what I talk about in the concluding chapter to the book is what it might mean to start a mobilizing process from the basis of rights-based legislation. Now, one can argue perfectly well that things like the NREGA, the Forest Rights Act, the Right to Information Act, and so on and so forth, were concessions granted by the UPA regime during the decade of its rule that were intended, if you will, to pacify social movements, or to bring social movements into a space where they could be contained. And that's true. But it's also true that these laws, through mobilization, can be made far more radical than what the powers that be intended them to be. So what I argue is that a non-reformist reform kind of politics should start from that particular space, the space of rights-based legislation, grab a hold of these laws and consistently define them and practice them in ways that defy, if you will, hegemonic intentions. And also to then think beyond, if you will, the divide between non-party politics and party politics, to enter into the electoral domain, to make use of, for all its limitations, the domain of electoral politics, and to draw lessons from across fields, from across, if you will, lower caste politics, class-based politics, the politics of the left in India, and so on and so forth, The call for non-reformist reform to be a principle in subaltern politics in the Indian context is, in a sense, a call to move beyond these various trenches that, how can I put it, different groups have been hiding behind and have been embedded in, which has prevented, if you will, productive thinking about how to move ahead with a progressive agenda for subaltern emancipation in the Indian context.
So is this what, you know, primarily animated you to emphasize, you know, not the traditional issue-driven social movement that, you know, we have across Adivasi India, right? Be it against SEZs, mining, real estate speculation. But I think what you do really well in the book is to also draw our attention to the longer dure ongoing structural conditions of disenfranchisement, right? So be it agricultural debt, be it migration, be it malnutrition, just the slow violence that is grinding down the Indian countryside. And you put together that with the possibility of the kinds of counter-hegemonic forces that then can crystallize. Did you think of these two things as something you wanted to address simultaneously in a single book, consciously?
Well, it's. I'm glad that you read what I've written in the way that you do, and that you think about it in these terms. And oddly enough, thinking back to my field notes, I was going through them the other day, and one of the first things that I write in my first field diary on one of the first days of being out there collecting all histories is that you know, a reminder to myself to think about this idea that Adivasi India, to use that term, which is problematic in some ways, but for want of a better term, is a window, if you will, through which it's possible to see the basic contradictions of the political economy of both democracy and development in India. That is, the way in which the political economy of development marginalizes groups such as Adivasis, and why that happens, and understanding that there's a relationship between the marginalization of Adivasis and the marginalization of other subaltern groups, be it Dalits, landless laborers, informal sector workers, you name it. Also, the way in which the political economy of power in relation to democracy leads to effective disenfranchisement, and then how it's possible to contest all of that. So yes, very much. I mean, to me, it's been a question of developing an analysis which doesn't sideline or posit Adivasi movements and indeed Adivasi communities as a kind of separate domain that requires a separate analytical optic. It's been about trying to emphasize how, when we look at Adivasi struggles, we're actually looking at one particular manifestation of some very fundamental contradictions in India's political economy. And in looking at these struggles, it's also possible to think about the struggles of other groups. And it's precisely in doing that, and I think this is quite basic to activist logic, you know, in that one thinks across struggles and tries to the best of one's ability to think about how struggles in one locale will be related to struggles elsewhere and how to make real that connection through solidarity. That's been, you know, fundamental to trying to develop this analysis, and particularly to trying to develop the analysis in the final chapter of the book, where I talk about non-reformist reform and the necessity of situating non-reformist reform at the heart of an oppositional counter-hegemonic agenda in India. And it's also why I've chosen to write this book as a book about subaltern politics, if you will, not as, you know, a book in what you might call Adivasi studies. I think it's important to have those dialogues across fields going, both, you know, scholarly and sort of intellectually among critical scholars, as well as in the field of mobilization and activism.
What is next for you, Alf, in terms of research and writing?
I'm working on a book project with two colleagues, which is coming out of a project that ran between 2014 and 2018, in which we look at the relationship between law, state formation, social movements in India over effectively 100-year period, from the 1920s till up to the present day, and the way in which law can be a prism through which to view the way in which social movements have impacted on state formation in India, and conversely, how state formation has, if you will, conditioned and impacted on social movements. So work is proceeding on that, and that's going to be the main focus of my work for the next year or next couple of years or so.
That sounds ambitious, mm-hmm. and look forward to reading it. In the meantime, all the best for your new position in South Africa, and thank you so much for joining us here on New Books in South Asia.
Thank you very much, Madhuri. It's been a pleasure.